Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartz-Trubber. On today's show, tech policy in the EU and how it's different from the United States. We've often talked about tech policy issues in Europe before without actually having European guests on the show. And my good friend Julia, who's German, rightly criticized me for that. But now today we have an opportunity to actually get a perspective from across the pond about the various issues that we debate here in the United States, similar issues over in the European Union, and how the two continents approach these issues differently. So joining me to discuss this are two great guests. I have Dimi Dimitrov, EU Policy Director for Wikimedia in Brussels, and John Weitzman, Legal and Policy Advisor for Wikimedia Germany. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, our pleasure.
So listeners, just for your reference, the term Europe might be said a lot today. We're probably referring to the European Union, might use those two terms interchangeably, but we are talking about the European Union and the member states under its jurisdiction. So to start off, when we talk about how Brussels has certain authorities and the member states in the European Union have certain authorities, when it comes to tech policy, what are the things that are decided at the Brussels level?
So maybe let's start off with the most obvious of all of the tech policies, copyright. In this case, copyright limitations and exceptions are set out in an EU directive. But the directive just says that member states may implement a certain list of limitations and exceptions and have to implement only one mandatory exception. All the other ones are up to member states. So it varies widely. There are member states that have introduced all of them and member states that are extremely restrictive about this.
And that's a directive. So the difference between that and maybe a more binding situation is that the directive says to the member states, you must do this, but if they don't implement it all in the exact same way, that's fine. I mean, what did they just look the other way?
No, they have a threshold of implementation and they can adjust it to their own culture or historic background, whatever they like best. They have to stay within the frame, but then they can, then they do as they please. And there's the other instrument that you were talking about, the more binding one, that's a regulation. So it's a different type of instrument on the EU level. And that's, for example, what's happening now in the data protection field. There we have a regulation for all of Europe, which is immediately applicable to everybody. No implementation, no moving within a frame or anything. So that's these two different types of instruments.
Another example that would be a exclusive EU competence, so something that is decided in Brussels alone, is the trade policy, foreign trade. And we all remember, I believe, ACTA, the anti-ACTA protests. And this was something very much handled by the EU and by Brussels.
Okay, so one of the big issues when we talk about tech policy is obviously privacy, and there are different layers there. There's privacy from government, there's privacy from companies, there is just the data protection issue in general, the way that data are processed and used for commercial purposes, for government purposes, and there are these two values that are sometimes in conflict, don't always have to be in conflict, but there's the right to privacy and the right to free speech. And, you know, at least to me, it looks like that calculation about how to strike that balance is different in the United States and in Europe. So could you speak a little bit about how in the EU they've struck a different balance between privacy and free speech that maybe Americans might be comfortable with?
Yes. So I like to joke sometimes that we're divided by the same set of values. It's just when it comes down, when push comes to shove, sometimes we put the priority on a different value than on the other side of the big pond, as you said earlier. One such example would be, for historical reasons, Europeans value the right to privacy much higher than in the States, where the right to freedom of speech and no censorship of media is just trumps all other rights in many, many ways.
And what would you attribute that to? So when you say historical reasons, I mean, I've talked on the show before about how East Germany certainly had an influence on the way that Germans think about privacy, but maybe more, we're talking about more than one country here. So when you say historical reasons led to Europe prizing privacy more than free speech, what do you mean by that?
Well, maybe start with the freedom of speech and freedom of media expression. It is restricted in almost every European country in one way or another. One prime example I would give is in Germany and Austria, all kinds of Nazi propaganda is prohibited. So you're not actually allowed to show or to fly the Nazi flag in Germany and Austria for, well, I think very understandable reasons.
Yeah.
While in the UK and in the US, this would completely fall under the freedom of expression and freedom of speech and freedom of media. So you can very much say, yes, I really like Hitler and I like his ideas to become popular again.
Yeah.
Which is completely illegal in many European countries.
Yeah, and we've seen a lot of that kind of thing on our social media, especially over the past couple of years, which has posed interesting questions for people who don't necessarily believe that hate speech should be protected. But under the First Amendment, of course, hate speech is protected. Now, there was this big policy debate, at least that maybe we were observing it incorrectly over here, but there's this concept of the right to be forgotten now. And that is not something enshrined in U.S. law, or at least not something that people are required to practice. Can you explain what the right to be forgotten is and how that came about?
Well, the right to be forgotten that we are talking about right now, like the recent development.
Yeah,
modern. That is basically case law that has developed on the highest European a level of jurisdiction, which is the European Court of Justice or the Court of Justice of the European Union, to be more precise, which is something like the Supreme Court of the European Union. You could think of that as like the next building here next to the office, the Supreme Court, something like that. And they ruled in a case which originated from Spain, where someone had financial troubles in the past, and that had been in the press. And then years and years later, it was still visible somewhere on Google that he had these problems, and he wanted it deleted from the Google index. And at some point, the court said, yes, he has this right to have it deleted after a certain. So they make a different. They bring in different factors, which is how public was this person. How long has this been in the past, and all these factors. And then they came to a conclusion that it has to be deleted, actually. And that set off a whole kind of an avalanche of discussion and other cases where other people also wanted their stuff to be deleted from Google.
Yeah.
Even though they are these things are not deleted from the press archives, because which is a bit weird about this whole reasoning. The things are still allowed to be in press archives forever, basically. But on the internet, where you don't have to go to the archive, where you just enter a search term in your search engine, there it is. It has to be deleted. And this is kind of the recent development. But the history or the culture of deleting things from the public eye, it goes back way further than that.
Yeah, so I think that was lost on a lot of American observers, because they looked at this case and they said, 2014, the financial troubles were documented in 1998 in a newspaper called La Vanguardia. And initially, the Spanish Data Protection Agency said, well, actually, the article itself is accurate. The facts are correct. So what exactly is your problem? But then it looks like, and correct me if I'm wrong, the legal ruling is that search engines, so that would include Google, but also its competitors, are responsible for the content they point to, but the newspaper can still maintain their archives. Dimitri?
Well, one thing that even most Europeans and even most European data protection activists would agree with is that the court ruling was, well, let's be diplomatic here. Let's call it half-baked. It wasn't a very well-written court ruling. And then another thing that is quite often understood wrongly, and especially understood wrongly in the US about this whole debate, is that people quite often mix up two things here. There is the right to be forgotten, which is actually in many European countries quite an old principle. In France, they've had it for, well, at least for decades. It used to be that once you've committed a crime, and let's say there is this example of a bank robbery, and this person robbed the bank, and then it was written all over the newspapers, and then he went to prison for about 10 years, and then he was released. And then the logic behind this principle in France was that once you've paid off your debt to society, you should be able to be reintegrated, to be a full member of society again. And therefore, you cannot really do this if the newspapers keep bringing up your name that, you know, you've robbed the bank, so you would never get a job, actually. So that's why in France, they had this restriction that once you've, once you're released from prison after that, then also the newspapers, they can report about that case, but not mention your name anymore because you're sort of cleared. And now this is, of course, a lot more problematic on the internet. And then we have this problem that we can't really solve this. I mean, it's really like a catch-22. You can't really solve this without censoring the internet, and censoring the internet is bad. But another thing that was demanded at the same time by the European Union as a new law that was really debated was the right to data sovereignty. So something that says that I'm allowed to have Google or Facebook delete all my personal data that they keep on me. And now what happened is that Google took this really terrible court ruling and used it to make a huge lobbying campaign against this right to data sovereignty. So they on purpose actually made it sound A, much more terrible than it is, and B, on purpose mixed up two issues so they could actually push through their lobby agenda.
Okay, so there's a conflation there. And we've talked on the show before about how both companies and governments exploit confusion over tech policy to push unrelated agendas because it is such a confusing area of policy that the average person is not necessarily going to understand. But sticking with the right to be forgotten briefly, we're not actually talking about data owned by a person. So the concept of data sovereignty might not apply here, right? This is more about your reputation. So you're saying that the newspaper's reporting on what I actually did, things that are true, because if they weren't true, that would be a separate issue. That would be libel or slander. And there are laws in the United States that deal with that, and people get paid a sum of money that is somehow related to all the money they lost because of the damage to their reputation. But that involves falsehoods. You sometimes can get a defamation case saying that they said something about me that was true, but it hurt me so bad. Why did they say it? But really, it involves falsehoods. And now you've got, obviously, Americans are scratching their heads because you've got the First Amendment, which applies to Google equally as it applies to the press. And then you've got Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act in the United States, which we've talked to about on the show, which is unlike anything you see in the world, where in federal law, it says platforms like Google, like Airbnb, are not held liable for the content that is put on their neutral platform. Now, you could obviously say it's not a neutral platform, but there's this idea that just because something is on a website does not mean that website is responsible for taking it down. And part of the problems we see with that is it's a mandate, right? Maybe Google can afford to employ a bunch of people to take down sites and respond to requests. Maybe a smaller company could not. Does this lead to censorship? The Spanish man who, you know, defaulted on his home, there's a very sympathetic case. The poor guy can't get a job. But you see people like celebrities trying to exploit the right to be forgotten. My favorite case was the disgraced ex-CEO of Merrill Lynch, who was one of the villains in the financial crisis. He was asking Google to remove links to BBC articles about the fraud he committed. And I don't think there's anyone in Europe or the United States who thinks billionaires are the ones that this ruling was targeted at. So what do you think do you think this is good policy? What is on the books now in Europe? What would you do differently?
Well, a definite bad point of that is that that the whole infrastructure of removing stuff and deciding on these complaints has largely moved to private companies like Google or Facebook. I mean, I know that they take a lot of effort to run this in a decent way. At least in Germany, they work closely with the data protection agencies. So about 50% of the cases or of the complaints they get, they just reject. And the other 50, they discuss with the data protection agencies. This is nice, but they are not the legitimate institution to decide on these issues. They are just companies.
Right. The mandate has almost turned them into regulators
in
a way.
Yes, it has, yeah.
And what would be a better approach?
Well, privatized enforcement is a major problem and a major issue for pretty much all European digital rights activists and digital rights organizations. So in the end, we must uphold the very basic principles of our states and our democracy that in the end, the courts decide. It is not private entities that get to set the rules and to decide on them. And yes, sometimes it may take longer. Sometimes the system may be imperfect. And well, sometimes it's also quite expensive. But I think this is just something that we need to put up with, because this is how a democratic society in the end works.
So yeah, maybe this was too much of an effort at a quick fix, right? I mean, you've got two big giant companies with a lot of resources, and the court said, you guys fix this.
Well, to be honest, I mean, and this is really just my personal opinion, I believe the, well, let's call it the right to be forgotten, although to be honest, the court ruling didn't use that term.
That's right, that's
term
what the media
given to
it.
The media. Yeah. The right to be forgotten, as we had known it in, let's say, in France for decades now, can not anymore exist in our modern world on the internet. So if we want some sort of personal protection against some things, we need to come up with a completely new system. But there is no way. I mean, the society changed, access to information and access to knowledge changed. It is a good thing that all of us can get almost free and unlimited access to archives. I think this is a very positive development for society. So at some point, we need to admit that we will also lose something on the other end of that equation. But the thing is, how much are we prepared to lose? And what aspects of private life should we really try to defend?
Do you see anything changing to wrap up this topic before we move on to the next one? Right now, we've got this interesting situation, like you said, where you have culture and certain laws that might have worked pre-internet, because it was actually difficult to dig up newspaper archives and try to do background checks on people. Now it's as easy as typing something in. Do you see the current regime just staying in place where, you know, you've got... they review it with the DPAs, they try to figure out which complaints are legit or not? Or do you see something changing here, either removing the right to be forgotten or codifying it through regulation? What do you guys think is going to happen?
Rather towards codifying it, I think, because the traditional ways are kind of very strong in keeping change away and trying to keep things as they always were, you know, these effects. And to get away from that would mean to say goodbye to this supply driven regulation, which says I'm going to cut off the supply to this information and that fixes it, while the American way is more like, no, everything's available, and on the reception side we fix stuff. If someone did something 15 years ago, then well, it's 15 years ago. This is a cultural change that would take like one or two generations, and so the lawmaking is not going to wait until then. They're just going to try and regulate it and codify it.
So you think the European Parliament will pass a measure that basically codifies the 2012 court ruling or the 2014 court ruling, which would essentially just make the current situation more permanent?
No, they didn't. The GDPR is already passed.
Oh, okay.
And we have, I mean, in the end, we don't have a EU-wide right to be forgotten, but we do have an EU-wide right to data sovereignty, which means like if I leave Facebook, I can demand Facebook to delete all my data and everything that has to do with me. And I think what will be up to the courts then to decide how far this goes, because of course I can delete everything they have about me, but what if I wrote a status? Yeah, a nice witty comment on the recent elections. And then 20 of my friends reposted it on their walls.
Right.
And then this was, in fact, already public information. So I asked Facebook to delete everything about me. But if this already appears on other people's walls, is that my information or their information? Or how should it work? Where do we draw the line? And this is something that, let's be honest, the CJ, the Court of Justice of the European Union, so our Supreme Court, so to speak, will have to decide on.
So let's get to that, because the other, you know, right to be forgotten is a very specific issue, but then there's the more general topic of just data protection, commercial use of data. And I do admit that I constantly switch between data and data. So apologies to the listeners. I haven't made up my mind about how to pronounce that word. But anyway, we'll use both for now.
How do you say potato?
Yeah, exactly. So there's a general sense that data regulation is stricter in Europe than in the United States, a very general sense, without getting too specific. And what I mean is that the requirements on companies like Google and Facebook across the pond are stricter than in the United States. And this might be hard to conceptualize, but any, if you're an American listening to this and you've traveled to Europe, you notice this when you open up your computer and every website you go to has a privacy policy that's actually articulated generally at the top of the website, and you have to accept that policy and the cookies each time. Whereas in the US, you just do it, and it seems like that is an effect of the regulation. Now, do you agree in general that it's a more permissive regime here, or what do you have to say about the way that Europe approaches data protection versus the United States? Thoughts on that? I know there's a lot there to unpack, but we could start up, start with the big picture.
Well, I'd say the difference in the general approach is, like, if in doubt, the person that the data is about, it's all about personal data. It's not about data in general. Should be in charge, and I guess maybe in the US it's the other way around. It's if there's nothing special that demands personal control on the data, then why should there be?
Yeah, maybe that's the difference. It could just be the difference between opt-in and opt-out. I mean, we see a lot of, I mean, I don't know that if that's explaining it 100%, but there is this idea that you're kind of required to opt out in the US a lot of times. Like, if you don't want them doing stuff with your data, you have to make a proactive choice to say, don't do this, or you have to activate encryption a lot of times. Whereas maybe you have to opt in more in the EU, I guess. I'm trying to get a sense of where the differences are between the two approaches to commercial data.
So maybe let's like even leave the data domain for a bit. Generally, when Europeans see new stuff, they're like asking themselves always questions. So how safe is it? Can we use it? What effects is it going to have on it? Well, I get the feeling that Americans, they just like to experiment a lot more, and they get much more excited about new stuff, and they're ready to jump in and, you know, just give it a shot. And it's the same here. I think there was a principle, the precautionary principle.
Oh, yeah, that's...
Maybe we can use that word here.
Yeah, I mean, that's more in environmental and health policy, usually, not so much in tech policy.
We use that here for tech policy too, precautionary principle, the idea that there is you always side with caution, and that with more approval required than the other side, which would be permissionless innovation, where you just do whatever the hell you want.
Yeah, or like where you're only allowed to regulate something when you have the proof that it is something that needs to be regulated. And the precautionary principle is more like, you're allowed to regulate it even though you don't have yet the scientific proof that there's a problem. And these are different approaches that I think they clash most in free trade right now. But they may be also at the bottom of all this different approach in data protection.
And when we talk about data protection, there is a special relationship between the EU and the United States as opposed to other data transfer agreements, because there was this thing passed in the year 2000 called Safe Harbor. And that was a general agreement that companies would uphold internally. And unless you hear otherwise, everything's fine, right? So you have big companies like Amazon, Facebook, and Google. They can store the data wherever they want. They send it across the Atlantic. And we generally in the United States saw this as a very good thing. Because of the Snowden revelations and people finding out that it was not so, you know, not so rosy a picture, that there were things that were going on that were very problematic, that agreement was overturned. And then we have a new agreement called Privacy Shield. Now, a lot of critics, including Tech Freedom, my organization, have said there are not really any significant differences between Safe Harbor and Privacy Shield. And that if Safe Harbor was struck down based on the logic that Facebook cannot guarantee data are protected because the NSA has access, if they cannot make that guarantee, then they cannot say that they're protecting Europeans' data. Under Privacy Shield, is there any reason to think that's different?
maybe one funny thing about Privacy Shield in Brussels is when the Court of Justice of the European Union struck down Safe Harbor, the first thing that the Commission did is with their comms department, that they came up with the new name and the logo, Privacy Shield, before they even started negotiating the new agreement.
Yeah, I mean, marketing is really important.
It was absolutely down to marketing. And I think Max Schrems, the person who sued in the court case, was it called Europe versus Facebook. I think he marketed his,
Max Schrems was the Austrian law student who sued under the logic that his Facebook data were not being protected.
Exactly.
And he won.
According to European data protection standards, and therefore this, privacy shield and safe harbor essentially are a self-certification mechanism. So American companies go to the Department of Commerce and they say, we really apply all European data protection regulation to the letter. And then they say, well, cool, here is a certificate that you really do. And there is really no control coming along with it. So Mark Schrems just thought, well, that can't be right. So, you know, he sued and he eventually made it all the way up to the European Court of Justice. He struck it down. And Mark Schrems was in Brussels a few months ago. And he said, well, I'm doing the same thing again with Privacy Shield. There is really no reason why this one would hold up in court.
Well,
the exact same reason.
It's funny you mentioned that because someone at an event asked Max Schrems the same question a while ago. And his answer was, if someone in the audience has 100,000 euros for me to make the lawsuit, then I'll do it. So maybe he was able to raise the money.
It's underway.
So. I'm pretty sure donors are easy to find.
Yeah. And so now we've got this situation where, and not to toot our own horns too much, but Tech Freedom, the day after, we put out a statement saying Privacy Shield is a farce because we did not see any significant difference. And the people they empowered to check on Europeans' data don't actually have the power, right? So the problem is American intelligence agencies, right? They're the ones who do the surveillance that allowed Safe Harbor to be struck down. And in Privacy Shield, we've got the United States saying, well, we'll put someone at the State Department and that'll be a clearinghouse for complaints. And then we'll get Commerce more involved and the Federal Trade Commission. None of those three agencies, not one of them, has any authority to reform the NSA's practices at all.
Correct. Maybe just to run through a very personal and practical example. If I, as a European citizen, think that my rights are being violated, I have the very fundamental right to sue, like to ask for my rights to be respected. And this was the problem with Safe Harbor, is that I had no redress mechanism. There was nobody I could complain about, nowhere I could sue against that. So this is why the court struck down Privacy Shield. Safe Harbor. So now in Privacy Shield, there is, I think, an office in the Department of Commerce, and then there is an American ombudsman on data protection, which I think will be created just because of that.
Yeah, at the State Department.
So, you know, thanks to us, you got an ombudsman now.
Great in jobs. Thank you.
Welcome. The problem is that I, as a European citizen, basically all I can do is send them an email or a letter, and then they don't even have to look through it. I mean, they get to decide whether they pick up the case or not.
Right.
So I do not think that a European court will really say, no, I mean, it's fine. All our fundamental citizenship rights are completely respected now.
So there are many reasons for reform. And of course, one reason is that the rights of Europeans are being violated. Given American political realities these days, I'm not sure that's the most convincing argument because one of the issues is the program that caused a lot of the angst in Europe. It's Section 702. It's a foreign surveillance authority in the United States. That's generally seen as an important tool for counterterrorism, right? That's the general conventional wisdom in the United States, that this is an important program. It can't just be abolished. Now, getting to the redress mechanism, there's a bill in Congress right now that we've supported called the Judicial Redress Act that at least would give Europeans rights under the Privacy Act. Our take is that that's not enough, that you do have to actually reform the way that the NSA conducts surveillance in Europe. Do you think that would be enough to keep Privacy Shield, to keep it going, if we made meaningful reform to the NSA, or do we then also have to put regulations on Google and Facebook? I'm just trying to get a sense of what you think would be enough to keep Privacy Shield alive. Because right now it looks like the European Commission and the Department of Commerce are gambling that something will happen between now and the end of 2017 that will assuage the concerns of Europeans.
No, they're pretty sure that Privacy Shield will not hold up. even the people who wrote it within the commission, but they wouldn't tell you this, well, of course, in public, but they will tell you this after the fifth beer in a bar. So it's they know it's rubbish and they know it's going down. It was just, well, something bad happened. We need to fix this quickly. What's a quick and dirty fix? Let's just do it and... Well, let future commission worry about this.
Yeah,
this was
takes,
sort of the approach to that.
And it takes a couple years, you know, for so this allows them to conduct business as usual in the meantime until the lawsuit goes through the courts, or if under some certain political realities in the United States, the government reforms surveillance. Now, the argument I've been trying to push is it doesn't matter whether you care about the rights of foreigners. If you want to be really selfish and just think about the United States, those companies are going to lose business. So I don't know what is going to get through, but what do you think the US would have to do to convince Europeans that their data are being protected?
I'm too realistic here to believe that anybody in the US will really care about protecting Europeans' data. But for this, we have our own governments and we have our own structures and our own courts that should protect our data. It's like, we can't ask the US government to protect our data. It needs to come from us. And thus, I don't believe that anything the US can do will really solve the issue if we don't make it a priority. And I think, well, we do need a new agreement because we can't stop that data flows between the EU and the US. That's just...
Yeah, that was going to be my next question.
Unrealistic.
Do you think there's a danger with data localization, right? If we don't see reform and the agreement goes down, are you going to see a big push for data localization? And for listeners who are unfamiliar with the term, it basically means if I'm German, my data is in Germany. If I'm French, my data is in France. And then instead of storing data wherever it's cheapest or wherever it makes most sense for a business perspective, you're now making that decision based on nationalism. Do you see that as a danger without an agreement?
No, ain't going to happen either way. But so I think the pressure will just grow to have an actual agreement. I think one of the more sensible proposals I've heard in the debate for privacy during the Privacy Shield negotiations inside the European Parliament was, well, we know we need something to patch this up quickly because we have a gaping hole in our legislation now and in the transatlantic data flows, and we can't allow this to stop. So let's just have the privacy shield with a sunset clause. Let's just have it for 5 years, and it expires in 5 years. And during this 5 years, we start negotiating a new sort of treaty between the EU and the US for exchange of data.
That sounds like what we call kicking the can down the road,
exactly.
Dealing with it at another time.
There will be elections. So, you know, after the elections, the newly elected people can deal with that. But at least that was a clear message. We can't wait for the court to strike this down again. Let's just have like a sunset clause and start negotiating now. Well, now we're basically just waiting for the court to strike it down again to start negotiating again.
So to wrap up the show, in the interest of this being a learning experience, and I've certainly learned a lot talking to you two, so thanks again. What do you think the United States and the EU can learn from one another? You know, there are two policy approaches, right? Some are similar, some are not. There are shared values, there are competing values, right? We're constantly trying to balance things like privacy, free speech, cybersecurity, national security. These are really complicated issues, and there's no silver bullet. What do you think we can learn from Europe? What do you think Europe can learn from the United States? Are there approaches that you think either side of the Atlantic should be adopting from their friends across the pond?
Well, something that we can learn, I guess, is what you said before, that the sky is not falling every time you experiment with something or have something new come around the corner. There could be more in Europe. There could be more willingness to accept change and to accept innovation and just the future coming at you.
Optimism.
Yeah. That is definitely something I think we could learn. Otherwise, the other way around.
Well, maybe let's just end with that. The internet is a common space, and both the EU and the US can break it. So
let's hope not.
All of us who are either digital rights activists or working for organizations that deeply care about digital rights should realize that we're so intertwined that we basically depend on each other. I, as a European citizen, depend on US legislation and what the US government does, but also US companies and US citizens are quite influenced by some decisions taken in Europe and the way they influence policymaking on the internet. So basically what we really need to do is team up in Brussels and in Washington and in San Francisco and in Berlin and really have a common agenda and push in the same direction, because this is a common fight.
Well, what I'm hearing is that maybe the EU can learn something about innovation from the US, and maybe the US can learn something about privacy from the EU. And maybe the two sides will work together despite all the reasons why they might not. But that's it for today's show. Thank you, gentlemen, so much for joining. My guests have been Dimi Dimitrov, EU Policy Director for Wikimedia in Brussels, and John Weitzman, Legal and Policy Advisor for Wikimedia Germany. Where can people find out more about your work?
On the Meta Wiki.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Let us know what you think of the show. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Feel free to pitch topics and guests. Find this podcast in the iTunes store. Please leave us a review, because it will help others find the show. Thanks for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.